Let's review what we said yesterday. Remember, our goal was to understand how you can take a quantum circuit, which is noisy, and find a different quantum circuit, an encoded quantum circuit, which is going to be reliable. So even though the encoded circuit is noisy, our goal is to show that it's accurate up to any accuracy we want. So the basic idea of showing this result, and keep in mind that this proof I'm showing you, this specific construction I'm showing you, is just one way of showing this result. There are some other examples which don't follow exactly this stream of ideas. They are kind of different. And I'm pretty sure there are other examples to be discovered of completely different schemes. But this is kind of historically the first idea. It's the simplest one. It's the cleanest one if you want to understand what's going on. So the idea I was discussing is you take your ideal quantum circuit, the one that expresses the algorithm you wanna run. So I represent it here as a space-time diagram, and I've just drawn with boxes just denoting two of the elementary operations in this circuit. Remember, the operations are you always prepare some single qubit states, and then you do some sequence of either single qubit rotations or two qubit interactions, and then in the end you always measure, or maybe some of the qubits are just left alone, you don't care about them, right? So you always prepare states, and in the end you always measure or ignore states, okay? And the idea we're discussing is you take now this ideal circuit, you encode by taking you're looking at every elementary operation in it, so looking at every operation like this one, and then replacing it by a collection of many elementary operations that are supposed to perform the same operation, but now in a logical way. You have chosen a code, and now this whole collection of operations are supposed to do the same operation, but now inside your code. Okay, and you repeat the same for every operation. You do the same replacement. Maybe the objects are different for different operations, but once you know the operations here, you know what objects you're going to use in the encoded circuit. Okay, and so what we wanted to show is that if now in this encoded circuit, which is noisy, you have noise, so every operation in the encoded circuit, every elementary operation, say if every elementary operation fails with some probability, that's a simple noise model we want to analyze. Say if every elementary operation fails with probability epsilon, or otherwise is ideal, then we want to show that this encoded circuit behaves as if you had a purely unencoded circuit, so as if you had the circuit you started with, which is now noisy, so as if you had a noisy unencoded circuit, where the noise was kind of different, where the noise had changed from having probability of error epsilon to having probability of error epsilon with a subscript 1, where you're hoping that you can show that this new kind of renormalized probability of error can be bounded by something smaller than epsilon. Okay, so this is a mathematical statement, right? What I mean is that this encoded circuit that you're going to do physically using noisy operations is going to have some output probability distribution for the measurements you do. And I'm arguing that you can show mathematically that there's a different noisy circuit, which is in your head, so it's used in your analysis, which has the identical probability distribution for the output, and which is acted by a different noise. Okay, so when you do the analysis, instead of thinking about this circuit, well, if you have this result, you can think about this circuit, which is simpler, because it's not encoded. Okay, so as part of the argument, the mathematical argument, an important fact is to determine what are the constants here, and the exponent here. So the exponent is kind of easy. It's related to the number of, it's related to the code you use. It's the number of errors that the code can correct. The constant, on the other hand, is more complex. It's determined on the actual circuits that you use, on the actual composition of objects that simulate every one of your elementary operations in the unencoded circuit. So to determine C, you have to do some combinatorial analysis. I'm gonna discuss later how you do it, but keep that in mind. what I wanted to say before is that if you want to read more about this, so this idea that the encoded circuit is kind of more robust than the unencoded circuit, it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of obvious or intuitive, if you want. So this result was known a few years after the first quantum codes were discovered. So in 96, 97, there were already papers written about the quantum threshold theorem. Okay, but this formalism of analyzing the circuits in a kind of mathematical and clean way was only discovered almost 10 years afterwards. So the first paper was in 2005. And then 2 or 3 years afterwards, there were more detailed and more comprehensive papers discussing this idea. So in the literature, this idea of relating the accuracy of an encoded circuit to the accuracy of a virtual unencoded circuit, because you go from something encoded to something unencoded, you can call it level reduction. So the level of encoding is reduced. Or in this paper, there was another name. This procedure was called the threshold dance, because some things were dancing in the circuit when you were doing it mathematically. So all of these are great papers. They are all very long, so they're very comprehensive. You can understand all the details if you read them. So if you want to go back and understand what this coefficient is, I have to show you more about the encoded circuit. So imagine that we look at the ideal circuit, and there is a sequence of two operations. There's a sequence of two unitaries, U1 followed by U2. So what we're going to do, our strategy, is we're going to replace every, in the encoded circuit, we're going to replace every unitary in the ideal circuit by some object, some encoded unitary that acts on many qubits, which are encoded on the code we have chosen. Okay, so U1 is replaced by some box for the moment, which we call the logical U1. I need to specify later what is inside this box. And similarly, U2 is replaced by U1 logical. And in between every logical encoded operation, we try to correct errors. So in between them, we do quantum error correction. For every sequence of two successive operations in the ideal circuit, we do a quantum error correction in the middle. Okay. So kind of pictorially, this unitary is replaced by this red box. That's the dotted box in the picture above. And this one is replaced by the other red box. So when you do the combinatorial analysis, in fact, what you need to look at is kind of the blue box. So if you want to do the combinatorial analysis for this, for the later red box, for the box corresponding to U2, you need to look not only at the elementary operations inside this region, but also in the quantum error correction that comes before. So this is a mild complication, but it's not so bad, right? Because you only have to go back one quantum error correction step. Okay, so in order to determine C, this constant in the formula, we need to look back at these blue boxes. Say, take the largest largest blue box in the entire encoded circuit, and say you count how many operations there are inside it, and call it C capital. Okay, so a trivial bound you can put on the constant C is just C capital choose T plus 1. So you choose which T plus 1 elementary operations in the blue box have errors. And that's the combinatorial factor. So you know that the encoded circuit is going to behave well if there are two T errors, because the code can correct T errors. But as long as there is one additional error, so T plus 1 or more, the circuit is going to fail. So the combinatorics you do is you count in how many ways T plus 1 or more errors happen in your circuit. And you don't need to look at the entire circuit. You only need to look at regions like this blue box here. Okay, so you look at all the blue boxes, you find the biggest one, and you do this combinatorial analysis. You look at how many operations, and you choose T plus 1. So that's an upper bound, of course, because the constant might be, the bound might not be tight, and in fact, in many cases, it's not. But if you want to get an upper bound, that's good enough. And then this constant epsilon 0 in the threshold theorem, what we call the threshold accuracy, is just related to this constant C, so you can find it immediately. Okay, so if you put the simplest code, like the one people used in the first analysis, and if you don't do a very complicated combinatorial analysis, you just use a bound of this form, and you plug in the numbers, you find that epsilon 0 is something like 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. Yes? Oh, well, there's another blue box for U1. So this is the blue box corresponding to this red box. So every red box has a corresponding blue box. The blue box corresponding to U1 is U1 together with the error correction that comes before it. So there's an error correction coming before it, and so on. Okay, and so once you have this mathematical procedure that allows you to relate the accuracy of an encoded circuit to the accuracy of a virtual unencoded circuit, you are 99% to proving the theorem, because what you can argue is that instead of encoding the circuit just once, you can repeat encoding it recursively. So you take every operation in the circuit, you encode it, and then you look at the resulting circuit, you take every operation, if you encode it again, and say you do it recursively k times. Okay, that's the procedure you use to improve the theorem. And now if you do that, you can use this formula that relates the noise strength of the unencoded circuit with the accuracy of the encoded circuit. So if epsilon is the physical noise strength, then because you encode, the theorem tells you that the encoded circuit has an accuracy which is effectively this other number given by this bound. And then because you have done the encoding recursively, you can repeat the argument. So you put epsilon 1 in place of epsilon, and you find an epsilon 2. So there's a recursion relation of this form. For every j, the epsilon j is related to the epsilon j minus 1. And the initial condition is that you start with a probability epsilon for faults, right? So if you solve this recursion equation, you get that after you repeat the encoding recursively k times, you get something like that. So the final effective noise rate for the encoded circuit, for the entire encoded circuit, is kind of a doubly exponentially small in the ratio between epsilon and epsilon zero. Okay, which proves the theorem. The theorem said if epsilon is less than a constant epsilon zero, then you can make the effective noise as small as weak as you want. Okay, so if the effective noise is related to the effective noise strength acting on the entire encoded circuit, so this shows it can become as small as you want. In fact, it drops very quickly with k if epsilon is less than epsilon zero. Right. How many times do you need to repeat this recursive encoding, you mean? Is that the question?
Not the recursive encoding, just how big you can be before you have to do that.
The circuit you want to implement needs to be before you need to consider doing error correction. Well, this argument doesn't tell you. That's a different calculation. You have, say, if the circuit you want to implement has some number of gates, say capital L, and if every gate has some probability of being faulty, say epsilon, then if you don't do error correction, you expect the probability of the final result of the entire circuit to be something like L times epsilon. So if L is small enough, such that the product is much less than 1, then you can just run your circuit and then run it multiple times and then do majority voting. That would work. The problem is that this only works if epsilon is order 1 over epsilon, if L, capital L, is order 1 over epsilon, which is typically very small.
What I mean is, in this scheme, you don't say you have just n gates.
Yeah.
So you don't have to have error correction after n gates. This tells you.
In this scheme, you have to have after every logical gate.
Yes.
So after every logical operation, you have to do quantum error correction, not after every gate.
So this is an elementary logical operation.
So this box is not an elementary. There's something inside it. It's a box. It's a black box for the moment. There's some elementary operations inside it. Yes. it represents one logical operation, but inside it there are many elementary operations. We're going to do an example. Okay. Okay, so that's what we said yesterday. So today I wanted to do these three things here. One is show you some examples about how you construct these boxes, these encoded operations. Okay, and there are two different cases. One is, of course, everything, all the constructions depend on the code you start with. So in most cases, you want to choose the code very carefully, such that as large a number of encoded operations is going to be very simple. Nevertheless, we don't know of a code for which all of the encoded operations you want to do are simple. So you always have to do some extra work. So that's the second case. This extra work uses an idea which is called teleportation. So in other words, the teleportation protocol is used in order to implement gates. It's kind of a simple idea. I'll go explain that. Okay, so once you know how to do the encoded gates, once you have filled up these boxes, then you need to worry about how you do quantum error correction. In particular, you want to worry how you measure the operators of your code, the syndrome that Daniel discussed yesterday, in a way that is reliable to noise. You have to be very careful how you measure these operators. Okay, now to start from the first point, so what do I mean when I say we have to be very careful what we mean when we say that this box, this encoded operation, performs the same operation on the encoded qubits as this operation U1 performs on the single qubit in the ideal circuit. What do I mean by that? It's kind of intuitive, but what do I really mean? What I mean is, imagine that you have an encoded state in your code, say it's ideal, there's no noise up to that point, and then say you apply the encoded operation. And then say you take the output and you decode it. So you take the encoded state and you decode what it is to a single qubit. Okay, then if this box really did the encoded operation on the encoded qubits, it should be the case that the output here you get on the state that you get here, is the same as if you first decoded your encoded state and then you applied the unitary that you want on the single decoded qubit. Okay? Sorry? Again? Yeah, so, well, in this equation, sorry, it's pretty obvious. Let's say this equation is just perfectly ideal. Everything is ideal. So this is just a mathematical statement about what I mean formally when I say that this box of elementary operations, remember there are many operations here inside, performs the same operation on the encoded state as the initial operation acts on the single qubit if I didn't use any encoding, okay? In other words, if you have a code and you give me some prescription about how I'm going to perform a certain operation in encoded form in this code, I should be able to use this formula to figure out whether you're right or not, right? If I plug in what you give me and I decode the output, I should see that that's equal to decoding and then applying the gate I wanted to the decoded qubit, okay? We're going to do that. So let's do an example. So the example is, I don't think Daniel discussed this code yesterday. It's the simplest stabilizer code. He didn't discuss it because this code cannot correct any errors, and he wanted to discuss error correcting codes. So this is the simplest stabilizer code that can detect an error. So it's not terribly good for fault tolerance, but it's pretty simple. So let's look at that. So this code has four encoded qubits. It encodes two logical qubits, and it has distance 2. Okay, so it has four qubits. Let's say we represent them in this square. The encoded states for this code are just the +1 eigenvectors of this stabilizer group. So the group corresponds to sigma x applied on all four qubits, and sigma z applied on all four qubits. And also the product of these two, so sigma y applied on these qubits. Okay, so that's the encoded stage for this code. And I told you there are two encoded qubits. So let's call one, let's call it L, capital L, and the other let's call it capital G. So the first encoded qubit has a we're going to define the logical qubit kind of indirectly. We're going to say what are the logical operators acting on this logical qubit. So the logical sigma x on this qubit is a sigma x on the first two qubits and the identity on the other two, or the identity of the first two and the sigma x on the last, on the third and the fourth. And these two are just the same because they differ by this operator, which is for which the encoded states are already a plus one eigenvector. Okay. So that's the Pauli sigma x, and the Pauli sigma z is just z on the first and the third qubit, or equivalently the second and the fourth qubit, after multiplying with these operators, which do nothing to our code. And well, how do you check I didn't make a mistake? Well, first of all, you should check that all these operators commute with the stabilizer operators. So if you already have an encoded state, that is, if you have an encoded state which is a plus one eigenvectors of these two operators, then if you apply an encoded operation, it shouldn't take you out of the encoded state. You should remain with some encoded state, which means, in other words, these operators have to commute with all this, and you can check that they commute. And also, in order for this to be a logical sigma x and this to be a logical sigma z, they have to mutually anti-commute, just like the Pauli operators in a single qubit anti-commute. And you can check they do. For example, this anti-commutes with this because there's a collision only on the first qubit. Okay, so this is how you define the first logical qubit, and you can define similarly the second logical qubit. And you can do the same checks. And there's an additional check. You need to check that these two logical qubits are really, you know, independent. So the operators defining one qubit, logical qubit, should commute with the operators defining the other logical qubit. So if you operate on one, you shouldn't change the state of the other, and vice versa. So you can check all these operators commute with all these operators. Okay, so what I'm going to construct some encoded operations to act on encoded states in this code. So I want to use pictures of this form. So I'm going to propose some implementation of an encoded gate, and I'm going to decode the output and show that the equation is true. So I need to have some expression for what the decoder is for this code. And, you know, it's easier before you do the decoder to do first the encoder. So the decoder is just the inverse of the encoder, and the encoder is just a procedure for taking two qubits in this case and encoding them into the plus one eigenstate of this code. Okay, so the circuit is here. So you have two qubits because there are two logical qubits for the code, and they go through a box that's the inverse of a decoder, that's an encoder, and out come four qubits. And here's how you do it. So you have the two logical qubits, say, on the top and the bottom, and you need two more extra qubits. So let's say one starts in the state 0 and the other starts in the state plus. So the state plus is just the plus one eigenstate of Pauli sigma x. So the plus is just an equal superposition of 0 and 1. Or in the Bloch sphere is something, if this is the equator, is a, so 0 is up here, plus is here. Okay, and you run the circuit, and so you apply a control knot gate as shown for four of them. And then the final state should be encoded in the code. The encoders and the decoders are usually not unique, so the circuit in the parentheses also does the same trick. So for now, just believe me that this circuit does it, and I'm going to show you why. So if you have the circuit that encodes two qubits into four in this code, then just the reverse circuit is going to decode four qubits in the code to two qubits output. Okay, so that's it. So it takes four qubits, and out go two qubits, and the circuit is just the reverse of the circuit above. Okay, so you have two output, and the two extra qubits are just in fixed states, so you can just trace them out. Okay. Well, another trivial trick is that if you run this circuit and then you run this circuit, it should be the identity circuit. Okay, and you can see that because a CNOT is a self-inverse. So if you run two CNOTs, it's just running the identity. Okay, so how did I figure out that this is the circuit that encodes the code? Well, that's pretty simple. If you know a few basic facts about the commutation, how Pauli operators commute through the control NOT gate. So let's agree that I'm going to use this notation. So I'm going to draw a control NOT gate, and I'm going to draw some operators, Pauli operators, before and after. And what the picture means is that if you have a Pauli operator before the gate, that's identical to having the gate and some Pauli operator afterwards. Okay, that's what the picture means. It means the Pauli operator kind of flows in time to become two Pauli operators in this picture. Okay, and so if you use this notation, there are four commutation relations you need to know for the control node. If you have a bit flip on the control, it becomes bit flips on both outputs. If you have a bit flip on the target, it just goes through, nothing happens. If you have a phase flip in the control, it goes through, nothing happens. And if you have a phase flip on the target, it goes through on both outputs. Okay, and now if you know this, then it's very easy to analyze what happens in this circuit. So say you want to understand what happens to this state, the plus state, when it goes through the circuit. Well, the plus state is the plus one eigenstate of sigma x, right? So you start with the plus one eigenstate of sigma x. And if you run it through the circuit using these properties, you find you have a plus one eigenstate of x on all the qubits, which is what we wanted, because remember, the circuit is trying to produce an output which is the plus one eigenstate of this operator and this operator. Okay, so just by using a plus state here and running it through the circuit, I produce a plus one eigenstate of the first one, of the product of sigma x and all the qubits. Okay, well, you can do the same thing with this zero. What happens to this zero? The zero is the plus one eigenstate of sigma z on the second qubit. So if you run it through the circuit with this formula, you get a sigma z on all the qubits. So the circuit also produces plus one eigenvector of sigma z on all the qubits. Well, and you should also check what happens to the qubits you want to encode. So the L qubit, if you put a sigma x here and you run it through the circuit, what should happen is you should get an encoded sigma x. You should get either this or that. Right? So that's what happens in the circuit. If you run sigma x through the circuit, well, it becomes two sigma x's here by using this property. And then the sigma x's are in the target of both these control nodes, so I use this property and they just go through. So you have a sigma x on the two qubits. And you can check what happens if you put a sigma z on the first qubit. It becomes a sigma z on the first and the third, which is the encoded sigma z for this qubit. And so on, right? So it's pretty simple. Once you have these commutation relations, you can analyze circuits of this form, which have only control nodes, because you know how the Pauli operators kind of commute through the circuit. Any questions? Okay, so why did we do all that? Well, we wanted to understand how you can implement some encoded operations with this code. So say I want to perform an encoded Hadamard. Remember, a Hadamard is an operation which takes a 0 to a plus and a 1 to a minus. So a plus is a superposition of 0 and 1, and a minus is the same superposition but with a different sign. Right? Or another way of writing this is like this. Okay, so that's the operation on a single qubit. Now we want to do the same operation on the four qubits of our code. which means if you start with an encoded 0, say for qubit L, the operation should take you to an encoded plus for the qubit L. Okay, so what I argue is that if you want to do the logical Hadamard, what you can do is you can apply Hadamard on every qubit, and kind of you can swap the two middle qubits and you're done. Okay, so that's pretty simple, right? How do you check? Well, I need to show that this is true, right? I need to show this formula is true. So, in other words, if I have an ideally encoded state, I apply this sequence of operations, and then I decode. So I have to use the circuit to decode. Right? And now the first logical qubit sits on the first qubit and the second sits on the last qubit. But say we only care about the first logical qubit, which is here. So say we take all these three qubits and we just throw them away. Okay? I need to show that this is the same as taking the same quantum state, decoding it first, okay, throwing away these three qubits, and then applying a Hadamard on the first qubit, right? That's what the formula says, if U is just a Hadamard, and D corresponds to the 4-qubit code. Is that true? Well, now, to do that, you need to know how to kind of, what you want in the picture is you want to move the Hadamard from the left to the right. Right? And that's pretty easy because if you have two Hadamards before a control node, that's equivalent to having a flipped control node followed by two Hadamards. You can check that. So this picture is the same as this picture right, which is the same as if I just twist the two qubits. Oh, I forgot to put the Hadamard. So the Hadamards come in the end, right? Okay, so I move the Hadamards after every control node. I flipped its direction all the way, and then the Hadamards appear in the end. Okay, so now if I twist the qubits, this control node will apply from the first to the second, this one from the third to the fourth, and this from the third to the first, something like that, right? And here I have some Hadamards. I throw these three away, and I have a Hadamard here. Right? Well, this is just a decoder because it's this circuit, right? So this one. I told you there are different ways to write a decoder. So it's not really this circuit, it's kind of this circuit, but they do the same. So if you can move around, in other words, you can move around the C notes further and reduce one to the other. So we showed what we wanted to show. That applying a Hadamard on every qubit and twisting the second and the third really does a Hadamard on the first logical qubit. So you can repeat that for other coded operations. There's a wide class of codes for which a certain useful set of operations is very easy to do. In this case, note that what we did is we applied the same operation on every qubit, kind of a tensor product of operations. Sometimes we say this is a form of transversal operation. Transverse or transversal. Okay, so if for a wide class of operations like CSS codes that Daniel discussed yesterday, the Hadamard can be done in this very simple way. And also a control node between two qubits can be done in the same way. So, and also for this code. So, maybe an exercise. So this is a CSS code. It's a stabilizer code. The code is defined as an eigenstate of a tensor product of Pauli operators, so it's a stabilizer operator. And it's CSS because every operator is either a tensor product of sigma x or a tensor product of sigma z. So, as an exercise for you is to do. How do I write this? So show that if you want to do a control knot between two logical qubits, so a logical control knot, you can do that by just taking you understand my abuse notation. So it means take every qubit on the first block of fours and apply a control node to the corresponding qubit on the second block of four. So just four control nodes transversely. Okay? So this is generally true for every CSS code. That's another exercise for you. Do I confuse you? Maybe I'm confusing you with this notation. Okay, I'll write it. Okay, so I gave you some idea about how you can do this simple kind of encoded operations. Yes? Can you speak louder, please? Yes. Yes. Right. So, in order for everyone to hear, the observation was that this operation, a Hadamard on every qubit and a switch, is also implementing not only a Hadamard on the first qubit, but also a Hadamard on the second qubit. So it's kind of so if you want to use both L and Z, both logical qubits, this is a prescription for doing a simultaneous Hadamard on both of them. And maybe if you use the two qubits independently, that's not good. Maybe you want a separate Hadamard for each of the two qubits. So definitely you need a different circuit if you want to do that. Okay, so for this code, you can do the Hadamard. If you use only one of the logical qubits, for this code at least, you can do the Hadamard pretty easily in this way. You can do a control node pretty easily this way I showed you. But what you can do very easily is kind of these funny rotations around the z-axis. Remember, to have a universal set for quantum computation, you want to do some rotations by an angle pi over 4 around the z-axis in the Bloch sphere, for example. Right? I don't know how to do it in a very simple way for this code. I guess it's probably impossible. So I'll show you some pretty general procedure about doing that. So that's the second point. So let's discuss how you do encoded operations by using teleportation. Okay, so first of all, what is teleportation? Oh, I don't have much time. So a teleportation is just this circuit. Yes. Sure. No, it's the more qubits, the more complex the gate. So it's relatively easy to do.
Try to get through.
Is that a question about how you experimentally do the gate now?
No.
Oh. Yes, yes. Okay, so the question is, how do people know what to do,
yeah.
Right? So in many cases, they just guess. For certain classes of codes, like the CSS codes, you can prove that certain gates can be done very easily. Like, you can prove the control node can be done in this transversal way for every code, so you don't need to worry about that. But in general, if you give me a code I haven't seen before, and I can't tell it's a CSS code, or it doesn't follow, it doesn't belong to some other family of codes I know, it's going to be tough. Yeah. Well, in general, if alternative, you would like to use as big a code as you want it, right? You want to encode your qubit into a large block of many encoded qubits, because that can correct a lot of errors. The problem is that for these big codes, it's hard to find a set of encoded operations. That's why in most of the analysis that have been done on fault-tolerant computing, you use simple codes for which you can design the gates kind of in your mind, but you know what to do ahead of time, right?
In this code, we're using 4 qubits to encode 2.
Yeah.
So like, why, for example, for the C-naught, why not just use the 4 qubits to encode the logical C naught? I mean, it seems like we're using too many qubits.
Oh, so this control node performs a control node from the on both logical qubits. So a control node from the first logical qubit on the first block to the first logical qubit on the second block. And similarly from the second logical qubit of the first block to the second logical qubit of the second block. Yeah. Okay, we don't have much time, so I'll just show you this idea of how you can use teleportation to perform gates. So I guess everybody's familiar with this type of circuit. For teleportation. Right, so it means you start with an encoded state. With an entangled state, so this is a, say, a 0, 0 plus 1, 1 state. And teleportation is just take your input qubit and one of the qubits in this entangled pair and measure in a certain basis, what's called a Bell basis. Okay, and then take the outcomes and apply some correction on the output qubit. That's usually the way people draw it. If you want to draw it in terms of elementary gates, this would look something like this. Okay, that's, so this is an explicit circuit, this one, for doing this measurement. And this is an explicit circuit for creating this entangled state. Okay, but so the idea of teleporting a gate is just the idea that if you teleport the state of a qubit, and after you've done the teleportation, you apply some operation on it, say U, then okay, let's erase the first part because now that's not equal to this. So if you do this, this is the same as if you did the U before you did the teleportation, right? So it's the same as if the same as if this U happened way, way here, where the initial qubit you want to teleport has not even interacted with the entangled pair of qubits. The same as if you do the unitary in the beginning, before this qubit and these two qubits have interacted, and then doing the measurement afterwards. Okay, and now what is going to change is that instead of applying these operators for the teleportation, you need to apply the conjugate operator. You need to conjugate these operators by U. So this is going to be something like this. You need to conjugate, that's confusing. You need to conjugate sigma z by U. I need to conjugate sigma x by u. Okay, so this line goes here. And this goes there. Okay, so that's trivial. Can you see down here? So you cannot. Okay, so the circuit, what I described is okay, what I described is this trivial equation. So if you do a teleportation, then you know the output here is the same state you put in, psi. And then if you apply some state on psi, some unitary on psi, it should be the same as, instead of preparing an entangled state 0, 0 plus 1, 1, prepare this entangled state, a different entangled state, do the same measurement, and then applying these kind of rotated Pauli operators. Then you should get the same output, right? So the reason why this is interesting is because in some cases, maybe it's difficult to do U, but it's easier to prepare this state here, the state where you have applied the unitary U on one half of a maximum entangled state. Okay, so what you trade is the difficulty of applying rotations with the difficulty of preparing certain states. Well, you don't. Maybe you don't, because you see this is just a way of writing a state. Maybe in order to make the state, you don't need to rotate. Oh yeah, so that's right. So this is really, the circuit only makes sense if these two operators are easier to do than U. That's, in many cases, that's the case. For example, if U commutes with one of the two, so sigma z, then the operators here are Pauli operators. So if you commute with the Pauli operators, one of them, say, then you just do the Pauli operator. There's nothing more to do. In some other case, you need to do some other operator, but that's easier to do than the U you started with. Okay, so that's what you would do if you had a single qubit. So now you want to promote this idea to what you would do if you had an encoded qubit. So the circuit, in fact, is used in an encoded way. So if you have an encoded state, and you want to perform an encoded unitary on it, but you don't know how to do it, you don't know how to find a box like this, which has many elementary operations to perform this encoded unitary, maybe it's easier for you to create the encoded state now, this state encoded in your code, and then perform an encoded measurement. And these encoded operations. Now for many codes, for many stabilizer codes, this is in fact the case. It's the case that you know how to do an encoded Bell measurement, and you know how to do the encoded versions of these two operators. And because you know how to do these three operators pretty easily, operations pretty easily, the problem reduces to preparing this encoded state. Right? And now it's generally easier to prepare encoded states if you know what you want to prepare, because you can do you can prepare lots of them and then compare them, and if you're not satisfied, you can always throw them away. You see, if you have an encoded block and you want to do an encoded operation, you cannot just say, well, I failed, I'll try again. There's no way to reject anything. But if you want to prepare a certain state, well, you can do it at your home before you go to your lab, right? Or you can do it in a different lab. Sometimes these are called factories. So there might be a very specialized procedure in some side of your lab. We just prepare certain states many times, and if it succeeds, well, it gives it to you. And then you can use it to perform some operation. Okay, so it's generally easier to create encoded quantum states if you know what the states are. And if you want to read more about it, there are many, many cool techniques about how you prepare encoded states and how you increase their reliability. So because these encoded states allow you to do operations which you don't know how to do otherwise, sometimes they are called magic states. There's only a few of them, like one or two, you need to prepare. And to increase their accuracy, you do what is called a distillation, something very similar to what you would do, for example, in quantum cryptography, where you would have many, many copies of an entangled state, and then you would try to combine them to create more accurate copies of, fewer but more accurate copies of Bell states. So there's a similar idea of how you take many copies of an encoded state of this form, and you create fewer copies of more reliable states of this form. That's called distillation. So if you look on the archive, there are many papers on doing that. So if you combine these easy operations, which are just transversal, with operations you do in this way by teleporting, you can, for stabilizer codes, you can, for any stabilizer code, you can implement a universal set of encoded operations. Okay, any questions? We have 5 more minutes. The last thing I wanted to discuss was some ideas about how you measure the operators in your code to figure out whether there are errors or not. But if you have any other questions about the previous material, we can skip that. Okay, so let's do that. It just takes 2 minutes. So let's go back to the code, this 4-qubit code. Okay, so remember this code cannot collect an error, but it can detect an error. And the way you do it is you just measure the eigenvalue of this of these two operators, right? What happens is if your encoded state has been affected, say, by a sigma x error on one of the qubits, then the sigma x error undercommutes with this string of z's. So when you measure the eigenvalue, you're going to find a different eigenvalue than plus 1. That's how you detect there is a sigma x error. And if there's a sigma z error, it undercommutes with this string of x's. And if you measure the eigenvalue of this tensor product of sigma x, you know whether a sigma z happened. Of course, if there's a pair of sigma x operators, if there's a sigma x on pairs of qubits or a sigma z on pairs of qubits, they commute with this operator. So you can't detect pairs of errors, right? But that makes sense because pairs of errors are just logical operators like these, right? So pairs of errors are not errors in a sense. They are operators on the logical qubits. So let's say you wanted to construct a circuit for measuring this operator, measuring the eigenvalue of this operator. You can use something very similar to the phase estimation circuits you discussed on Monday. So remember that if you have some qubit and you're allowed to use an extra qubit which starts in the state plus, so a superposition of 0 and 1, and you're allowed to apply a controlled Pauli operator, and you measure, what the circuit does is it projects this first qubit on either the plus one or the minus one eigenstate of this operator P. Right? So the outcome here is plus and minus one. And depending on the outcome, what the circuit implements is this operator. So it's this projector. So the circuit implements this projector either on the plus one or the minus one eigenvector of this operator P. Okay, so in our case, P is going to be a Pauli operator. It's going to be this string of x's. And instead of having just one qubit here, we're going to have four. So the circuit you wanted to do would be something like this. Right? This circuit projects on the plus and minus one eigenvectors of this operator. This looks funny, but what it is really is a sequence of four operations, or four control NOT gates. Right? Because a control NOT gate, it's just a nicer way of writing a controlled X gate. That's what it is, right? So if you want to have a controlled XXXX, you just have a control not. Right? So this circuit measures the eigenvalue of this operator. So if you start with an encoded state and you run this circuit, you always get eigenvalue plus one, no matter how many times you run it. But if you start with an encoded state which has an error and you run the circuit, maybe you get an outcome minus one, which means you have detected some error happen. Okay, so we are almost done, except that the circuit is kind of bad because if you imagine that the circuit has, if there's noise in the circuit, any operation in the circuit can fail, right? Well, if the measurement fails, you're going to get the wrong eigenvalue because of noise. Well, maybe you can repeat the measurement many times. You can have many circuits in a row, and then you can make the probability of the outcome if you take the majority voting very small, right? Or maybe a control NOT gate can have an error, right? And this might introduce an error in the measurement outcome you get, or might introduce an error on the qubit, and so on. But there might be much worse cases where, say, this control NOT fails. What this can do is it can damage the first qubit, right? But it also damages this qubit, which next interacts with all the other qubits. So it means if this control node fails in some weird way, which we don't know in advance, maybe all four qubits in your code can be affected just by a single fault in the single control node. That's pretty bad. Right? So there's a whole procedure, kind of what you wanted to do in your circuit is to prevent cases of that form. You want to have that when a single gate fails, at most one qubit in every block is affected, not more. Otherwise, the errors will proliferate. They will become, they will happen more and more qubits. So there are many, many, many procedures to prevent this kind of situation from happening. Kind of the first idea that Peter So used for dealing with this problem is just to observe that a plus state is just, as we said, a superposition of a 0 and a 1, right, proportional to this. So the observation is that what the circuit does is, depending on the state of the single qubit, it either performs something on the qubits in the code block or nothing. But you could do the same thing if instead of a single qubit, you had many qubits on there. So instead of having a single qubit, why not have four qubits? But now these four qubits should be prepared in a state, should be prepared in a state which is like that, right? It's either all qubits zero, so all four CNOTs do nothing, or all qubits one, where all control nodes do something, like in the circuit on the left, right? And here you see the same. So this, and then you measure every qubit here. You combine the result, and that's the same circuit as this one. So if you compute the parity of all these, the outcome is the same as the outcome here. So here, what is interesting to observe is that you use the same idea we used previously to teleport gates. In that case, we couldn't do an encoded gate. Instead, we prepared some quantum state, encoded quantum state, to do this gate. Here, we cannot do the measurement of this operator directly. But instead, we can prepare some state, some encoded state. This is an encoded state in a different code, of course. This is a repetition code. So we reduce the difficulty in creating the circuit to the difficulty of preparing certain states of this form with low noise, right? And as long as you can prepare and give me states of that form, I can use them in the circuit to measure any operator I want and detect errors, right? So of course, there's a whole procedure now that Peter described of how you prepare these states with low noise. So the idea is you make multiple copies of them, and then you compare them, and then you either accept them or reject them. If you accept them, you use them in the circuit. Otherwise, you try again. Noise in this circuit?
In the state,
right. So you need, right. So you prepare the state many times, and then you check whether there's a lot of noise, and you only accept if you believe there's a lot of noise, right?
Whatever there is.
Well, there's always going to be noise in the state. What you want not to happen is, say, a low probability event in the creation of this state, like a low probability event in this control node gate, creating lots of noise in all the qubits in this state. Right? So there's always failure. What you want to reduce is kind of the order of the events that cause catastrophic failure. So in this case, the order was first order. In the first order, you had a catastrophic failure. When you prepare the state, you want to have it that it's noiseless except for very high order events. So you can do it by designing appropriate circuits. I don't have the time to show you, but if you read these references, there are many examples of how you do that.
If you have
a few errors, no, because you see the way you use the state afterwards is if there is an error on, say, a single qubit in the state, well, it's going to affect only a single qubit in the encoded state. That's because what comes afterward is just transversal interactions between this state and the encoded state. The state encoding the information, right? You don't want to have many or all of the qubits having errors, but that you can prevent by checking carefully the state. Okay, I went 5 minutes out of time, so thanks. We're going to have a break and then John Yard. Okay, we're going to have a 30-minute break and then there's going to be another talk. Thanks.